Weird for me because I used to speak at Tech Heads quite frequently on Microsoft technology up until about 2 years ago. And I no longer use Microsoft technology anymore, pretty much apart from my gaming PC. But in those 2 years, I've learned a shitload about how to scale and run agile teams, which I'm going to talk to you about today. So I'll go through that. Sorry, there's the obligatory Microsoft format slide, and then these are mine after that. So it's not often that you know the exact moment of your managerial failure. It's not you know, quite often you can't look back and say, I really stuffed that one up. For me, it was, you know, again, at this new job, new technologies, things I hadn't really used before. And we were making some really major changes to our API. We were actually going from a polled synchronization, where you just keep on asking, to a much better system, similar to Twitter, where we had version numbers on all our records, so you could just say, get me the latest X versions of this record. And as we rolled it out, we saw some really horrendous performance issues. And you know, one night I was at home and I pulled up the code and tried to remember how PHP worked and had a look at some stuff and saw some really shockingly badly written code, some really terrible, you know, order n squared loops and this sort of stuff. And when I did a git blame on the file, it was written by one of our very best developers. And the moment I saw that, I knew it was my fault. It was my fault that that code got written. So yeah, you're probably thinking, right, who the fuck is this clown and why is he going to talk to us about running great teams when, you know, he lets that sort of thing through? Well, we'll get to that. But a bit about me, or a bit about Vend. We're a New Zealand cloud retail software provider. So I started by Vaughan Rousell 5-odd years ago, one guy in his garage or in his kitchen. We're now 200-plus staff, 6 offices worldwide, 15,000 retailers worldwide, all out of little old New Zealand. We have a world-class DevOps practice. So let's have a bit of a poll. Who writes code in the room to start with? Who ships code, QA test, all that sort of stuff? Okay, so keep your hand up if you ship to your customers more than once a week. Okay, there's a smattering. More than once a day. More than 5 times a day. All right, my hand. Oh, there's one hand on the back, maybe. Cool. So on a really quiet day at Vend, we probably deploy 5 times. Real quiet day. On a busy day, we'll deploy 30, 40, 50 times. Just because pretty much every Git merge to master, well, no, every Git merge to master goes into our production servers 5 minutes later. But then pretty much every, you know, 3 or 4 commits will be a merge. So we're super agile, right? We just move as fast as we can, we ship as fast as we can. And that brings about some interesting troubles. So what we've learnt over the past little while is this idea came from, I was reading, you know, investigating engineering ladders, you know, in terms of, you know, junior, senior, intermediate, you know, junior, intermediate, senior ladders. And one I looked at was from a great company called Rent the Runway out of New York. And the thing that really stuck with me about theirs is they talked all about technology and all sorts of stuff. When they got to the VP of engineering, they said the primary responsibility of the VP of engineering is debugging people and process. Not debugging systems, not doing tech, but debugging people. And after seeing a few talks and seeing a few interesting, and doing some investigation, I've actually come up with, I think, what's quite a strong system or a strong model for doing this. Like all models, it's completely wrong. So all models are wrong, some models are useful. So bear that in mind as I go through it, and also help you understand why you should probably completely ignore, well, ignore a lot of what I say. Take some principles from it, but ignore the rest. So we'll get to that as well. So what went wrong? What happened to cause this developer, this great developer, to write bad code? So what it was really was there was a whole lot of competing constraints and a whole lot going on. You know, we ship so often and we're moving really fast that a lot of decisions have to be made very rapidly in conjunction. And what happened was, even though we had a culture of trust and empowerment, and you know, JFDI is one of our company mottos is JFDI. Hopefully, you understand what that stands for. And you know, we have this culture, but what really was happening is that with the speed we were moving, the only people who really understood, I guess, the complete gamut of what was going on were people like myself, VP of Engineering, I'm Chief Delivery Officer. So when it came to, should we finish this properly and get this performance better, or should we ship it and move on to something else, it was easy to say, ship it and move on. And it wasn't easy to kind of understand all of the competing issues about that and how done it was and what was crunching this person's time. And so the funny thing was, is even though it was a trust and empowerment culture, it wasn't, because people would have to come to more senior people for decisions because there was a lot going on. But we want to retain that trust and empowerment culture. So we could fix this by going and getting the big giant picture of the scaled agile framework. Has anyone seen the scaled agile framework? Horrendous thing, right? You know, loops and lines and whatever's going on there. Or, you know, Prince 2 or something else. So we could do that, and we could also completely destroy everyone's creativity and will to live, right? So that would be an easy fix. We don't want to do that. We want to succeed with as few rules as possible. So why do we want to retain trust and empowerment and not use rules? I'm going to divert a bit as I go through this talk. My wife is a teacher. She's a secondary school teacher. Well, she's a stay-at-home mum at the moment, but she's a fantastic teacher as well. And she shared this book with me called Dancing About Architecture. That, again, gets on a real diversion rabbit hole. The title of the book comes from a quote from a musician who's got a bad review, and he said, well, writing about music is about as useful as dancing about architecture. So the book is called Dancing About Architecture, and what it talks about is finding creative ways to teach kids and how if you follow the rules, then you will be as good, at best, as good as everyone else. So therefore, you must break the rules as a professional, as a matter of, policy, so that you can be better than other people. You know, sometimes it'll be worse. Most of the time, if you're empowered and doing well, you'll be better by breaking the rules. There's a lot of other ways to look at this. Famous chefs say, you can be a really fantastic recipe cook. You can cook to the letter of the recipe and make a great meal, but when the shit hits the fan, you need to be a chef. Okay? You need to just have grounding, have principles, but not follow the rules. Jazz is another good example of that, right? Everyone from the same key and the same tempo, but very little rules otherwise. Okay. The other thing is, there's a bit of research been done into this, a bit of psychology and sociology research, talking about complex adaptive systems. The easy one of those is schools of fish or flocks of birds, that you can understand the way they move and why they move that way, but you cannot predict it and you cannot turn back the clock. You put your hand in a school of small fish and they will swarm around you and come back together again. You can't predict how they were going to do that. You can kind of see why and you can never reset it. So deeper into this, is again why we're not using a rule book or the scaled agile framework or Prince 2. So Dave Snowden, who's heard of Dave Snowden? So I'll go into a bit of detail. He's a kind of famous, he calls himself a professional curmudgeon, but he's kind of famous in the agile community for the research he's done and just this stuff here, which is, complex adaptive systems and more recently, or quite a little while ago actually, causality domains. So I'm going to explain this diagram a little bit. So the thing he's called Kinevan, which is a Welsh word, that's why it doesn't sound like what it's written. And this is a framework he's put together to talk about what you should try and do in each of these causality domains. So the easiest one to understand is obvious. So obvious causality domain is cause and effect is very straightforward. I poke this, that goes up over there. No problem at all. I poke it again, goes up. That's simple. Obvious cause and effect. In that case, then best practice is fine. Rigid Scrum rules, rigid SAF, Prince 2, if you... cause and effect is simple, then that's cool. In the complicated causality domain, it means that you're not sure how things will react in multiple different ways. You can try some inputs and see what happens, and generally you can get a good feedback loop going at the very least, A-B testing, that sort of stuff. So it's complicated, but you can still get an understanding of what's going on. In that case, good practice. So that's maybe where a bit looser Kanban, Scrum, bit of a, you know, some common agile, you know, rigors, but not necessarily adherence to the rules, because if you have to react to something, you need to be able to move a little bit. A good example in our case is Kanban is fine for our web shipping stuff, where we're shipping every time we finish something. Maybe not so much for iPad, where we have to ship and wait for Apple, so we have to ship on a schedule. And then the top left is the really interesting one, the complex causality domain, where you really have no idea what's going on. It's the school of fish again. And for us, as a fast-moving SaaS startup with multiple competitors in the space where our competitors can ship just as fast as we can, they can release weekly, we sit there. So while we might be able to predict how the market might react or how customers might prefer one of our changes, there's so much more going on and so much rapidly going on that things get very complex very quickly. And Dave Snowden recommends, in this instance, emergent practice, which is, again, try something and see how it works. Try again, see how it works. And if you asked a Vend employee, especially probably one in what we call our solutions team, which is, you know, product engineering, QA, all that sort of stuff, what you know, how they see change or how often things change in the way we do things, and they will probably say, you know, constantly, all the time, stuff's changing. We're changing the way we make teams, the way we ship software, you know, our kind of cadence, whether we A/B test or whether we do big design up front. We're just doing that as we go through life. So yeah, hopefully that helps you understand why we don't follow a full rule book. The other thing is, the more I've looked into Agile, and if any of you have been through the process of a adequately or even poorly performing team, been kind of working under waterfall, and then someone's come along and said, hey, let's do Scrum or Kanban, let's do something where a bit more Agile. Who's been through that process? Where things, yeah, okay, cool, a lot of you. What I find, I don't know if you agree, but what I find in that process is that you don't get faster, you don't get better, because you're working as hard as you can already. You get more honest about what you're doing. You go through your first sprint and you say, wow, we only finished a quarter of what we said we were going to finish. And so you adjust and you do it again. Oh, we finished a half. Oh, then we're on pace. You haven't got faster, you've just got more accurate and more honest about what you're doing. And I think that if you have a great team and a great setup and you're really thinking about these things like not following a rule book but doing the right thing, then what you'll find is the actual core thing is honesty and being honest with each other about where you're at rather than process. So, given that we move fast, we're in a complex causality domain, we would like to think that we can do a lot of what we do without necessarily having to apply rules, where do we go for answers on this? So I've looked into a couple of things, a couple of different aspects. The first one is learning from others, which is going out and talking to people from Spotify, Netflix, GitHub, Etsy, this sort of stuff. And I say talking to because I'll get to a point where you'll understand why that's important as opposed to reading the white papers. And the other is a whole lot of new ideas that I've synthesized or we've synthesized as part of our team. So I'll go through those each. So learning from others. We'll spend a bit of time on this slide. I had this four separate slides at one point, but I just threw them all together. So who's heard of the top left there, the Spotify model of tribes and chapters and all that sort of stuff? Okay. Who applies the Spotify model in their workplace? Cool. I've got bad news for you guys. There is no Spotify model. Okay, so there's a great white paper written by Anders Iverson and the other guy, sorry, I can't remember his name. I don't know Anders' name because I had lots of beers with him in Sydney a few months ago. So the thing is, they wrote that white paper to describe what they were doing at the time and what worked for them in their complex causality domain at that point in time. Some of that stuff they still do. Some of that stuff they've thrown away. Some of the stuff they've munged in different ways because they're constantly changing what they do. And Anders is quite, you know, he laughs and he's quite kind of upset that it's been latched onto so hard as a model. And this is the answer to all your problems. which is interesting. What they do really well is this top right one, which is high alignment, high autonomy. So if you haven't read that white paper, if you haven't Googled what Spotify do, then go away and do that, because it's really interesting stuff. And there's a lot of valuable principles in that stuff. So this chart at the top right just talks about the fact that, you know, obviously low alignment, low autonomy means everyone's just doing their own thing and it's kind of crazy. High autonomy and low alignment, to be honest, is probably where Vend was a couple of years ago. Great people doing great work and just going off and doing their own thing. Really interesting stuff being built, but no alignment to the same goal or the same, you know, role of work. Likewise, top left, you know, no autonomy, high alignment, whip-cracking boss. Don't want that, right? So you really want autonomous people who can empower to do what they want to do, but a really clear alignment. Just go over to that North Star over there as fast as you can, doing what you know how to do well. And that's really what we're aiming for, and I think that's what Spotify has done really well. So there's an interesting phenomenon, though, about the Spotify model. Again, if you talk to people, so I met with guy Chris Angove at QCon New York, who is from Spotify New York, and he pointed out that the tribes with a collaborative product owner worked really well in Scandinavia. But in the USA, the product owner wanted to be the boss. He wanted to be in charge. And it just didn't quite work as well. It still worked all right. It didn't quite work as well. And so they're having to fine-tune that. We'll get onto this in a sec, but there's a really interesting thing there called cultural relativism, which we'll talk about. So then there's Netflix, bottom right here. Who's read the Netflix culture slide deck from 2007? It is compulsory reading if you're involved in software development. Go and read it. Write it down. I'll give you a second to write your notes down. Netflix culture slide deck. Google that. It talks all about Netflix's approach to culture and people. And, you know, things like their unlimited leave policy and why that works and empowerment and this sort of thing. They go through a few slides to explain this thing here. So what it is that, you know, with any business over time, the business gets more and more complex. You get more people, more customers, more product, more features. It gets more and more complex and harder to reason about. On day one of a startup, on the left there, you've got a founder and a co-founder and a couple of technical people who all understand the entirety of the business and the complexity the business is involved in, right? Cool, great, you can just reason about the whole thing. But as you grow and you employ, you know, some interns and some juniors and some HR people and, you know, lawyers and whatever, then, sorry, can you not hear me when I turn away? Is it all right? Cool. What happens is there's a point where the business becomes more complex than the employees are able to reason about. Okay? So all this, like, think of something like Microsoft, probably, or Google or Amazon or Facebook. The business is so huge that no one individual or even a great department of individuals can understand everything that's going on, all the moving levers. And typically, this triangle here between complexity and the performance of employees is filled with process and rules and papers and HR and legal and all this sort of stuff. And what Netflix does is they get this red line to stay in front of the blue line by only ever hiring the very best people in the industry. Great, easy. How much does Netflix pay for a Scala engineer in San Francisco? I've got a friend who works in the machine learning team in Netflix. Who wants to? Okay, let's try. Do you think? How we do this? Hands up if you think it's more than $150,000 US a year. Okay, more than 200, 250, 300. Okay, his budget for hiring a Scala engineer starts at $300,000 a year. Who wants to, you know, go and learn Scala? Awesome. To be honest, it's a Scala engineer who knows machine learning and can work at the scale that Netflix works, all that sort of stuff. But they do that because they know that Scala engineer they hire is going to be fucking awesome and hopefully keep them above the curve there. The flip side of that is they have another line in another slide that says adequate performance is rewarded with a generous severance package. So, you know, flip sides and this sort of stuff. So, cool, hey, yeah, that's cool. Let's hire really, really great people. We have no money. You know, we have a runway. We're not throwing off, I don't know, $50 million of cash a month like Netflix is. So we can't do that. So what we do is we've kind of learnt that, and we try and close or keep that red line up through learning, through a self-improvement budget. So we give our engineers a budget to go to any conference in the world to talk to the people that do this stuff and try and improve themselves. And we, you know, we bring in retailers, we talk to retailers, we try and make sure everyone understands the retail domain and our business as well. You know, we do an okay job of it. And then GitHub is the other kind of super agile, you know, darling child. And that slide is pretty interesting because I'm a manager. So, you know, where do I fit? I mean, I'm an engineer, but I manage engineers. I guess the interesting thing about GitHub, and I guess the unique situation they're in, is they are software developers writing software for software developers. And so understanding the domain they're working in is a little bit more easy for them than it is for us to understand the retail domain, especially the high-end retail domain. You know, someone running a, you know, 10 store with e-commerce and Pinterest and Facebook and, you know, all this sort of stuff, multiple employees, rostering, you know, it's not natural for me to understand that or for an engineer to understand that. So again, we try and live and breathe retail as much as we can. We have retail meetups. We go and when we rewrite our stock taking app, we send out the engineers who are going to rewrite that to do stock takes. They do stock takes with a couple of retailers before they change the code, and after they change the code, I make sure that it's much better than it was afterwards. So we try and close that cognition gap by spending time with our customers. So the thing is, all of these are similar in different ways. So all of these companies use very small, very agile teams, high empowerment, and also adaptive approaches. But you can't scale by copying, okay? This comes back to this cultural relativism thing. Dave Snowden, again, back to him, he mentioned that, you know, there was a UN development program. I don't know the details of this, I should know, but I just remember him saying it, that worked incredibly well in one country, say Bangladesh. So yeah, working really well, let's move it to somewhere else, sub-Saharan Africa, completely failed. Cultural relativism, because, you know, what works in one place, whether you have, you know, different people, matriarchs, patriarchs, or, you know, different village structures or whatever, is not going to work in the other place. The same thing is about, you know, applying Spotify model, Scandinavian, you know, who knows what their gender balance and people balance and, you know, skills and expertise are in that company, and you can apply it to your company with your specifics, it's not going to work well. It'll work okay, but it's not going to work great. So we can't copy, but we can learn from, you know, small focused teams as a commonality, very few rules, a lot of trust, high alignment, okay? We can copy these things. We can work from them. So what we do, just out of interest, what we do at Vend, so you can ignore this, right, because don't copy it, is we have small teams, and each team has everything they need to do to get their job done. So they have developers, they have analysts, team leads, testers in that team. So they can take a problem, not a solution, not a feature, a problem a retailer has, like I can't do my stock takes very well, or I keep selling out of stock, or I have too much stock, and they can then postulate a solution for that and build that solution and ship it. And then we put a bunch of those teams together. Now the really interesting thing about this is I asked one of our amazing designers, Jade, to just say, hey, can you scribble some you know, things like Spotify, like some lumps, some groups and some lumps and things. And she came up with the idea of making it look like a beehive. And the really interesting thing is, after I looked at this picture for a while, I realized that the shape of that is really important, because the team sizes are different, the members of the team are different, but they're all hexagons, and they all fit together. And there's something in our team, in our group, which is, I don't know if it's unique, but it's helpful for us in that if a team came along to Vend and they were circular or square, they didn't do CI and CD, they didn't do automated testing, or they were authoritarian, or all did things in a different way, they wouldn't fit, and they would be, you know, they would almost be rejected by the host. And it's kind of happened in that, you know, one of our front-end teams said, right, let's use NPM, cool, all right, let's do that, let's start adding packages, yeah, this is really good. And our deploys started to fail on a fairly regular basis, because the way we were doing deploys was shipping the code to every webhead and then running NPM update on every webhead, right? And NPM, if you know it well, will download up the internet, basically, when you run it, and, you know, it'll do 50 downloads of packages. And so across 10 webheads, if one of those now 500 downloads got a, you know, a 404, a, you know, a timeout, the whole deploy would stop because it was in an inconsistent state, would stop and say, no, deploy failed. And so we had a discussion and said, okay, cool, the front-end crew want to use this thing, this technology, so should we go to daily deploys? And it was just like, the reaction was just, no, absolutely not, fuck no, get out, we're not doing that. So we all worked on a way to do it better, which was just, you know, kind of pre-packaging and, you know, deploying the downloaded packages as a whole. So, you know, that's kind of just an example of we're inoculated with this, the continuous integration, continuous deployment ethos, and anything that tries to go against that will be rejected by the host. And so a team that doesn't fit with the way we do things, doesn't do all the basics, won't fit. And we do add on top of this, you know, a little bit of a Spotify thing, a little bit of, you know, chapters, quality assurance chapters, and some, you know, people to tend, people like me to kind of, or people like coaches and product leads to tend the direction, keep the alignment good. And then I thought about it actually where I am as I'm a beekeeper, right? I can come along every now and then and puff a bit of smoke in, but God, I cannot change what the individual bees are doing, what the workers are doing, how they're working, what their production is like. It's basically all I can do is get the environment right, and that's it. So, is that all making sense? Hopefully. How are we for time? Cool. So just coming back to all this stuff, the commonalities between all those, between the research that I've done on other models, and what we do is highly aligned, everyone going in the same direction, loosely coupled, small teams. If you take away the kind of directional arrows, you look at that and it starts to look a little bit like some sort of software boxology diagram. Who's heard of Conway's Law? Okay, Conway's Law says that, it's kind of a corollary, says that the structure of your software will match the structure of your company or your teams, and vice versa. If you structure your teams in such a way that they are loosely coupled, then you will generally get loosely coupled software, which we all think is a good thing, right? So that's really cool. So if we want loosely coupled software, we should have loosely coupled teams. So keep that in your head as we talk on. So then some new ideas. So back to that initial failure that I talked about, what was it caused by? Codependent teams, codependent deadlines, a lot of stuff going on, people not understanding what's happening. Monolithic architecture, we had a monolithic architecture, so you know, you change code in one place and it affects code in other places, so maybe this developer who was kind of bashing away on a new way to do our API was distracted by something else, so moved on to that, or something of the sort. Maybe an unclear or inappropriate context, so his context for building what he was building didn't include maybe performance or maybe how important it was to get this thing perfect before shipping it, rather than like our, you know, we tend to ship quickly, you know, deploy slowly, deployment percentages, so that only some of our customers get it first, and then, you know, fix as we go. But in this case, it wasn't an option, we need to get it right. So the thing is that, you know, team stuff, like teams getting, you know, falling over each other, poor context, poor coupling, bad coupling, or tightly coupling, we know how to solve these things in software, right? Hopefully there's a lot of engineers in the room. We know how to solve things like tight coupling and things like bad context. And we have some tools like bounded context from domain-driven design. Everyone knows what bounded context is? Hopefully, okay. If you don't, it's just basically, it's what it says, right? That if you define a piece of the software to have a bounded context, it only deals with the retail sale. It doesn't deal with inventory movements or customer balances or whatever. It's just the sale. It's a bounded context. So I can give it the information to make a sale and trust it to get it done, and it will probably tell other systems that it's made a sale, but its context is bounded. You know, in scope versus out of scope is another example of bounded context. You know, everyone knows how to deal with scope. Is versus is not. Adrian Cockcroft, who is the guy that basically coined the term microservices, spent a weekend with the team at Vend, and one of his favorite things was the anti-architecture. From an empowerment point of view, he said, I want you to do, you know, I'm just thinking a random example, a new search box for Netflix, and I don't want it to do this, and I don't want it to do that, and I don't want it to use Elasticsearch or whatever, but otherwise, go for it. And so he's created a context for that team to say, okay, we can't use, oh, this is probably wrong, I probably do use Elasticsearch, but you know, we can't use X, we can't use Y, therefore we must go and look at, you know, Z or A, B, and C. But as long as they're not doing the anti-architecture, he knows that he can trust them a bit more. They have a better context. Then there's this thing called Knaissance, which if you, I run a software conference called Codemania. Josh Robb gave a talk on Knaissance at that last year, and it was absolutely brilliant. It was the first time I'd heard of the term, and it really set my mind going. So let me tell you about this. Remember, we're talking about software concepts that might help us reason about team complexity. So what Knaissance is it's a software quality metric to allow us to reason about the complexity caused by coupling. And I'll go through and tell you why. And it's a tool to help us prioritize this. So it's not rules, but it's a metric, it's a way for us to think. So Knaissances are the ways in which different pieces of software are connected to each other, or where they kind of co-generate or co-evolve. So here's an example. It's an example, there's different Knaissances. I'll list them in a sec. I'm just going to move this. It's going to make noise. Here's one called Knaissance of Position. So the order, who's a coder in the room? That's cool. Good. So the order of A and B matter. If I said x.divide 2, 1, I'm going to get a different result. So the position, sorry, not the order, the position of those two parameters matters. If I swap them around, they're wrong. So we have a Knaissance of Position between the caller and callee of this function. This is really simplistic, but there's much more detail if you watch Josh Robb's talk and read about it. We can reduce Knaissance of Position, which is a tighter Knaissance, to a Knaissance of Name by naming the parameters to that function. So now we can call numerator 1, denominator 2, or we can call denominator 2, numerator 1 in a different position, and we'll get the same result. We no longer have a Knaissance of Position. We do have a Knaissance of Name. So, if you follow this, I hope I'm not melting brains, then you list them all down. So these are the Knaissances that Mia Page Jones identified in software. So you can see position is here in the middle. It's all right. It's okay to use it, but try not to. Knaissance of Name is fucking awesome. It's totally fine if I say, here's a customer, and you say, oh, cool, I know what a customer is. Sweet, we agree. Or if I say, here's a numerator and a denominator. Yay. But if I say, here's a name and an address and a whatever, and they have to be in exactly the right order, that's categorically bad. Everyone understands that, right? Cool. Anyone who's tried to code OAuth knows that Knaissance of Position, Knaissance of Algorithm are all just terrible things, right? So the Knaissances tell us, so stronger Knaissance at the bottom, weaker at the top, and also, the degree or the distance between the callers is what's important too. So a Knaissance of Identity, the very same object, object in C# or Java or whatever, object-oriented languages, if you're in the same class, not a problem, pass the object around, totally cool. It'd be dumb to strip that back to JSON or a string and pass it around inside a class, dumb idea, right? So Knaissance of Identity, totally cool if you're right alongside each other, but you don't want to be passing a C# binary object over the wire, right? You want to move all the way up to type and name. Here's a customer as a JSON string which has no connection to any language, right? It's just a list of names and values, and that's it. So are you on board? Knaissances? The Knaissances also come in two different types. Static, stuff that you can generally change before you compile, obviously. And dynamic, stuff that you won't find out until after you run it. So, execution timing, that sort of stuff. So together, bounded context and Knaissance help us understand the complexity of software and reason about the way it might respond to inputs and allow us to draw boundaries around what's inside this piece of software, what's outside, and how we should talk to each other. And also give us a little bit of a priority about what to tackle first. Right, a strong Knaissance maybe tackle first. A bad bounded context, maybe look at that too. But none of it is rules, right? None of it is you must do this, you must not use Knaissance of Identity, you must use that. It's just a system for reasoning, right? So my brain is going clarity, reasoning, prioritizing improvements. What if we applied these to teams? And we do apply them to teams at Vend. So what does bounded context applied to a team look like? So again, back to Dave Snowden. He calls these things enabling constraints to promote emergent practice. So if you say to a team, you know, build software, right? What are they going to do? You know? Whereas if you say, here's a box-shaped thing, you know, here's where you can work within. You know, you need to work with gift cards, for example. You're just pulling features out of the air about the sort of stuff we build, and say, team, please build gift cards for a retailer. And it needs to perhaps, you know, someone might have talked to some retailers, or otherwise just go and talk to them and understand them yourself, and sort of build some context around that. And again, we can go down to the technical level and say, don't do it in PHP, God forbid. you know, do it in a microservice that can run in Docker and that is fully instrumented and has a CI pipeline. Here is your context. Okay, work within that box. The other thing is, you know, even the team's context is really interesting. So we had a team that was fixated on a deadline. They come up with a deadline and said, we're going to ship this thing by, you know, 31st of May or whatever the deadline was. And as they went through, this was quite a big piece of work and it took, you know, several months. They got sort of, you know, within a few months of launch, and the ground had changed a bit. And the order of priorities of what retailers wanted had changed a little bit in that time. But man, they were fixated. They wanted to say, no, we're going to get everything done in this deadline. We're going to keep doing what we're doing. And, you know, almost to wake them up to change their context, I removed a person from their team. Said, this person is no longer in your team. They're going somewhere else. And changing their context and getting them to think a bit differently meant, well, okay, so we can no longer hit our deadline. What do we do now? Let's go back and think about it. Let's think about what we're trying to achieve and what the retailers want. And they reordered the priorities and kind of, we're able to ship in increments earlier on. We're able to ship things that were working and were okay. And it's hard to describe, but you know, we had retailers that would be happy with a fast search as opposed to quick key buttons, for example. Right? So why build all the stuff, fast search and quick keys, when we could actually ship to retailers who are okay with fast search and no quick keys? And kind of changing their context quickly allowed them to think about that a bit more. So bounded context for a team, pretty straightforward. What about connaissance for teams? So if we think about connaissance as reasoning about complexity, reasoning about connections between two things, between two teams, and helping us decide on a course of action, can anyone in the room think of what would be a good connaissance to share between teams? So a good way in which two teams might be connected to each other. Anyone? Audience participation, everyone's scared. So hand at the back of the room. Say again?
Type.
Time or type?
Type.
So type of team? Yeah, I think so, yep. Any others? So what about goal or vision? You know, it's a good thing for all the teams to share the same vision or to be tightly aligned on vision, and tightly aligned on the goal they're trying to achieve. It's a good thing for two teams to be to understand exactly who our customer is and to maybe even share the same customer in terms of talking to them and betas and, you know, getting the customer on board. Okay, so that's good. What about a bad connaissance? Can anyone think of something that two teams are coupled by or shared by that is bad?
Failures?
You say?
Values.
A bad connaissance? Or a good one? Okay, interesting. Why would it be bad?
Deadlines?
That's the one that I call the connaissance of Muppet Arms. We've all got the same deadline. Happens all the time to us. And the thing is that, like I say, it's not a thing to have a solution for. It's a thing that we can sit down with two teams or three teams and say, hey, look, quick, we discovered really early that you're all crunching on the same deadline. We've seen this before. We know how to fix it. Okay, let's stagger things around. Let's talk to marketing. Let's talk to our stakeholders and get those deadlines a bit more staggered so we're not all slamming at the same time. Okay. So the other thing is, if you start to identify these things, you can say, well, hey, the designer, we're short on designers. So if the designers are shared between two teams, then they cannot share a deadline. They just can't. So we can start to identify, you know, identify what connaissances can clash with each other as well. So these are the ones that I've kind of come up with over time, and I'm sure there are more. And I'm working hard. I'm actually working with Anders from Spotify and trying to identify a few more and work them out. But this is what we've got. And some people I present these to debate about my categorization, which is cool as well. Like I say, all models are wrong. Some models are useful. So I think about static connaissances as things that we can structure the teams to overcome or create the teams before we start to get right. So, you know, people, obviously, the right mix of people on the team, you know, and so that we're not sharing people between teams that it doesn't work. The location, we have a Wellington dev office, and it has been hard having teams split across two offices. I know that some companies do remote work, but, you know, we're not inoculated with remote work. We work closely together. And so, you know, we can say, well, let's try and keep the Wellington team working on one piece of work and the Auckland team working on another piece of work. And obviously, you know, platform. So we don't mandate. People use Go, Java, PHP at Vend. But if you're trying to use more than one of those things in the same team or you're working with another team who uses a different platform, you need to think about that. And then the dynamic ones that just change, that change all the time as we go. And, you know, the team can stay the same, but the dynamic connaissances can change as we work through. And so, obviously, the vision shouldn't change, and we should make sure that we have a shared vision between teams. And if the vision does change, if we're changing, you know, a good example recently, we rethink how we deal with pro customers, big retailers with multi-outlet stores, you know, 10 stores online versus, you know, a coffee shop, right? So that's it. We have different visions for those two different types of retailers. And that vision needs to be shared across multiple teams. It needs to be connaissant. You know, obviously, scope and deadline. Deadline's the bad one you want to stay away from. And so I've kind of ordered these as well to say bad to good in a way. Bad deadline, you know, I don't know, getting there. So I'd love to hear your feedback on that stuff as well as to whether it's, you know, whether it's close. So together, bounded context and connaissance give us a framework for reasoning about the complexity of team interactions, the complexity of how we deal with teams. And they let us identify really quickly when things are out of kilter. Okay? So the key thing is that, like I say, it's not a rule book, it's not a mandate, but it allows us to talk to each other as teams and say, we have a deadline connaissance, or we have a people connaissance, we've seen this before, we always talk about this stuff. So how do these things help us? So this is an interesting quote. It actually came up when I first wrote this talk, just as I was finishing it, and I thought it was bang on, right? So yes, Scrum is fine. Yes, Kanban is fine. Yes, SAFe might be fine for your organization. But don't blame the process if your teams and your bounded context and everything else is wrong. So we want to reduce rules to retain creativity and empowerment, right? We want to keep everyone empowered. If you want to know why people should be empowered, read a book called Turn the Ship Around by Dave Marquet. He's a nuclear submarine captain. Really great book. And if you think empowerment and, I guess, leadership from the bottom is not easy, read that book because it's about, like I say, nuclear submarines. So if you think your corporate organization is hard to kind of change, imagine the rigidity of Navy life on a submarine. It's amazing. And interesting anecdote he gives is that he moved from the submarine with best morale to a brand new submarine with terrible morale, really brand new, shiny machine, giant nuclear reactor, all this sort of stuff. They went underwater, and he said, as the captain, he said, right, ahead one-third electric power. And the navigator said to the engine room, ahead one-third electric power. And the engine room came back and said, this ship does not have a one-third setting under electric power. And so he obviously said to the navigator, why the fuck did you pass that order on? You know, that's dumb. It's wrong. And the guy said it was an order. And so he changed the whole way the ship worked to say, get people to say, I intend to go ahead full power, because that's all we have on electric, you know. I intend to do this. Are you okay? Sweet. Good. So if a nuclear submarine captain can change the chain of command to be an empowered chain of command, then you can do it too. Don't take any excuse. So we need creativity and empowerment because we're in a complex causality domain. We also need to retain clear context and healthy connections between teams without slowing people down. With bounded context, we have enabling constraints for the teams, places for them to work safely within without creating anti-architectures. And by working to observe and identify the connaissance and coupling between the teams, because it is easy to get a single team, a good group of people working together, it's an easy thing to do. But to get multiple teams when you're scaling and when you're growing, it's really hard. So we want to identify these connaissances and coupling so we can fine-tune the effects between teams and identify the bad ones before they cause us trouble. Right? And more interesting, I think it's a meta layer above things like Scrum sprints and features and software, right? Because it's a disempowering for your team to talk about when you're going to be done with this deadline or what things you're doing in your sprint or this sort of stuff. You really want to be talking at a higher level about that empowerment stuff. So, like I say, by doing that, you end up with in a place where instead of adjusting levers like scope and deadline and sprint size and this sort of stuff, you're actually adjusting people's output and people's their empowerment, their box within which they can work, and the coupling between the teams. So, summary. Ignore what I've said, right? Don't model yourself after Vend. Don't model yourself after Spotify or GitHub or Netflix. Apply the principle that you find from those things, not the process or the model. Okay? And then use and go out and research these things. Go to conferences, talk to people about the things they've written. Okay? And then use bounded context and connaissance, if you want, to provide a system for debugging those teams and people. And that's me. I'm open to questions. I'll be available here and in the common area afterwards as well.